Let's look at the war through the NBC War Telescope. It is focused each Saturday at this time on London, where members of NBC's London staff bring you interesting sidelights on the war. Today it is Merrill Muller, so go ahead, NBC London.
London. All day long, London has echoed the roar and rumble of aircraft engines. Hour after hour has gone by with the thunder of American motors overhead at some time during each 60 minutes. Our NBC coastal observers report a record daylight attack going on across the Straits of Dover. Again, walls are shaking, doors are rattling, and pictures bouncing off the walls of South Coast English homes. Even as the pounding now continues, with successive relays of fighter bombers, light bombers, and medium bombers, the American 8th Air Force has just issued a communique of two heavy daylight assaults. The fact that this communique has come out so early, and after two missions have already been completed, emphasizes that a full blitz is on, and there is still some 3 hours of daylight left for yet more attacks. About 500 American bombers and fighters went to the Pas-de-Calais and Boulogne areas to plaster military targets in two separate raids that were described as strictly milk runs. A tremendous weight of bombs has fallen in these two areas in the past 24 hours. Both the American and Allied air forces have concentrated much of their bombing efforts on the coastal strip, except for the RAF's attack on the Trap railway yards last night, which we now know cost 17 British planes. Seven enemy night fighters were destroyed. This great air domination not only means bombing death and destruction to the enemy, it means an open channel of attack from the skies by men designed to fight on the ground. There is a great new arm for modern warfare, a weapon with the deep offensive striking effectiveness of the air forces plus the all-important ground occupational value of the army. So far in this war, this Russian-invented weapon has only been locally employed on a limited scale. But if we can believe German warnings to their West Wall troops, the world is about to see the greatest application and exploitation of aerial assault ever conceived. That will be the airborne attack phase of the coming invasion of Europe, the deep penetrations of the enemy's lines by the 9th Air Force troop carrier command planes and gliders filled with air commandos of specially trained infantry and parachutists. The word glider, however, is the key to the tremendous value of this new means of warfare, and today's war telescope is dedicated to the 9th Air Force pilots who fly the glider planes and fight with the troops they land within the enemy's positions. These men are dual-purpose personnel. Their silent gliding means of transportation have more uses than is commonly believed, and above all, their work is not that of suicide squads. The enemy's radio reported that the Allies have between 80 and 100,000 airborne troops ready for the attacks to come. And our own radio recently announced the arrival in this theater of a military glider pilot from Southeast Asia. That officer, Major William H. Taylor, Jr., 33-year-old leader of the glider section of the 1st Air Commando Group in the Burma campaign, was ordered to England to advise the troop carrier command on what to expect on operations. Major Taylor, who was awarded the British Distinguished Service Order for his work with the General Wingate Colonel Cochran Air Commando Forces, says he comes from Washington, D.C. He's here in the studio this afternoon to give you an insight to glider-borne infantry operations.
Gliders give any task force commander everything as a means of attack that has ever been dreamed of. It makes it possible to design bombardment missions with the intention of occupying a target and not destroying it. You can drop a glider combat force with greater fighting power than any bombing effort. Such a force can be dropped anywhere in the enemy lines, providing tactical surprise, and it can fester there or retire. No such mission, when well planned, is a suicide assignment. It's a mistake to think any commander would waste picked troops like that.
It's a teamwork job, isn't it, Major?
It's the essence of military perfection, requiring the greatest cooperation of troop carrier, tug plane, glider pilots, the airborne forces, and the coordination of the other ground and air forces around our mission.
That implies a change of conception from just spearhead units of attack to a self-contained airborne attacking force.
Right. That's one of the lessons we have learned. Airborne forces are no longer considered a diversionary body. They are a type of secret offensive weapon that keeps the enemy tense and nervous and throws the enemy into confusion when they strike. Surprise and confusion are two of the airborne forces' greatest assets. It means the enemy must employ a large number of troops on scattered protective assignments rather than fighting in his front lines. Thus, our mere organization makes us effective whether we are employed in attacks or not. Once we are used to attack, we are doubly effective. We are not only fighting on the ground, but the balance of our strength still threatens to strike at other points from the air.
And, of course, your range of operations is limited only by the extreme range of your tug and supply planes. Theoretically, you could land and fight inside Germany if your tug planes could keep flying supplies and reinforcements to you.
We can operate anywhere within our aircraft's range, even landing our gliders on devastated territory that would obstruct normal air forces.
That raises an interesting point. Can you describe the composition of an airborne force of glider troops for us?
Well, an airborne outfit is an infantry division specially trained with the kind of weapons necessary to employ because of their type of transportation. The weapons are normal type and caliber, but made in light metals and of compact form for air transportation. An infantry division with these light weapons is complete even with its own engineer companies and attached aviation engineers for the flight strip, except for heavy artillery and tanks. However, in these are with us in the air. Dive bombers and medium bombers assigned to an air commando group for an operation serve as artillery to the airborne outfit. Strafing fighters act as the airborne scouting tanks.
A complete striking force from the air, but intended to occupy strategic ground. How does such a force fit into an army on the ground?
Perfectly. When the ground army makes contact with an airborne force, it merely joins hands with another infantry division which has some air engineers attached working on the airfield that has been taken or built.
Airfield, then airborne forces not only divert enemy troops, but supply the means of continuing and strengthening the attack by building airfields?
If an airborne force is not assigned to the capture and repair of an airfield, its attached aviation engineers start building one as soon as they are landed by our gliders. The gliders can go anywhere, but our tug planes or the bomber and fighters have to have strip fields to operate from. And remember this, once such a strip is built, the glider forces that land to build it can be flown off again to another attack.
Which means airborne forces are limited in tactical employment only by the imagination of the theater commander. With so much improvement of airborne operations since the German invasion of Crete, and with the experience of General MacArthur's and Colonel Cochrane's forces, General Eisenhower's imagination can end up anywhere. Such operations, however, must put a great deal of responsibility on the shoulders of glider pilots.
Yes, but they are trained for that. A glider pilot is the best all-around soldier of the Army. He has had the full field training of a soldier plus the full training of the Air Forces. He is a member of the Air Forces, but he is attached to fight with the Army on the ground. A glider pilot's first duty is to land his forces behind the enemy lines and then climb out of his glider and fight with the troops until relieved or evacuated for further missions.
That's a diversified assignment and a tough one.
It's not all the glider pilots are called on to do. Plenty of jobs await them in the European attack, just as we had many types of work during the Burma attack. Some of my boys out there, after landing their gliders, served as artillerymen, combat engineer, airbase crews, and commandos. Then they were brought out to fly another mission. Some of them made three such attacks, fighting throughout each. This reemployment eliminated the suicide theory on our operations. While we had gliders time after time, we employed on support missions, diversionary attacks, as flying hospital and mobile engineering units.
It's amazing to learn the gliders we use for mission after mission.
Not all of them are. Certain attacks assignments required them and will require deliberate crash landings into postage stamp clearings. That's when a glider pilot is called upon to display great skill and courage to place men safely at the right spot. You will remember General Wingate used exactly those words, great skill and courage, in praising our work in Burma. Even the men we carried out there who were from standard British infantry outfits, not trained airborne groups, said they would fly with us anywhere, anytime.
That is an enviable compliment, and I'm sure very well deserved. Will there be any comparisons in your forthcoming work in Europe with that done by the Air Commando Force in Burma?
Some. In Burma, our mission was not only to attack the Jap, but to seize some of his key centers and supply lines. The object was to take the only limited offensive permitted us before the monsoons broke. We didn't have the strength to mass in for a full-scale attack, and gliders made it possible to carry out surprise local attacks. More than that, the methods of attack we used, cutting the Jap supplies, forced the enemy out of the jungle to fight us. And then he was easier to get at. We proved a considerable force could be maintained by air for such local fighting out there.
And here in Europe?
The terrain and the problems are very much different. The terrain is simpler, the problems more complex. And of course, the airborne plans are so mammoth that the logistical requirements are not solvable by air transportation alone. However, we learned a lot of things by mistakes in Burma, and those lessons will be applied to save a lot of lives here.
Can you give us one example of such lessons, Major Taylor?
Well, we learned that if a section of an airborne invasion goes astray in the air through no fault of its own and lands in the wrong place, it still helps. As long as it is able to fight, it helps the overall invasion plan by its commando diversionary effect. The enemy can never be sure that any airborne forces is the main attack. A diversion or an accidental foray into his lines. Until he finds the answer, he expects the worst and deploys strong forces accordingly.
How did you happen to get into gliders, Major Taylor?
Like many of our glider pilots, I wanted to fly power planes, but I couldn't satisfy some of the requirements. I was always either married or too old, so I volunteered for the gliders. Most of our glider pilots are volunteers.
What do you think of your glider equipment?
Our gliders made by refrigerator companies, piano makers, beer companies, are very fine. We proved in Burma that our American gliders will carry a much greater load than ever believed possible. I was overloaded in mine when I was first to land on the Broadway Strip outside Tathaw in the first General Wingate operation. Mine was the first glider of a team.
Then that was the proving ground for this service.
In a sense, yes. It was certainly a testing ground for an airborne commando team to seize an airport site, hold it, and construct an airstrip for further operations. We improved the condition of the Indo-Burma front, and by helping shorten the air route to China, have almost doubled the amount of supplies going into that country.
The success of the 1st Air Commando Group in Burma was a great boost to those who wondered about the stagnation of the India front. I'm sure that further successes and more decorations await you here in your work with the Air Troop Carrier Command that will strike into Europe. In your lectures around the bases here, have you noted the attitude of the men?
Yes, and it's excellent. They have an exceptionally strong morale. They know what they are up against, and they are ready to do the job.
You have some plans for Berlin, then?
All the boys have, and not even the Krauts will stop them.
Good. Save some beer for me. Say, where did you get that southern accent?
Big Creek, Mississippi.
Thank you very much, Major William Taylor, and good luck to you and to the airborne forces. May you confuse and defeat the enemy as effectively as you did in Burma. War Telescope, the penetrating inquiries of the hows and wherefores of modern warfare, has completed with today's broadcast a survey of the entire formation of the ground forces that will operate within Europe. In their own voices, it has brought you the plans and feelings of the men from all the tactical units of the forces, the men who are about to do the job of ending the dark ages that descended upon Europe since the rise of Hitler. And now, before closing down, here are the last-minute news inserts from the day in London. Early evening reports from the Italian front state that despite firm resistance from the enemy, the Fifth Army is well inside Kesselring's final defense lines, and although there is not a breakthrough, there are prospects of early exploitation. The Eighth Army overhauled the enemy's retreat so rapidly in the central sector today that reconnaissance troops and sappers destroyed an enemy force in the process of digging in holding positions on the hilltops. Every Britisher here is discussing the historic flight of the American Mediterranean bomber forces to Russian bases yesterday and the implications of that success, implications both political as well as military. They emphasize that where Englishmen and Frenchmen preceded them to fight by air from the Russian front, the Americans have not only moved in to do the same, but have effectively tied the Russian and Mediterranean battles into a common front. Now, Britishers are eagerly awaiting the first word of an RAF bomber force joining the shuttle line between either England and Russia, or Italy and Russia, and Britishers would prefer both air forces shuttling on both routes. This is Merrill Muller reporting for War Telescope in London, and returning you now to NBC in New York.
And so until next Saturday at this same time, we put away the NBC War Telescope, a presentation during which members of the National Broadcasting Company's London staff present unusual sidelight stories on the war. Today you've heard NBC staff man Merrill Muller interviewing Major Cochran and Major William Taylor and speaking about the glider transported troops and equipment. This presentation of the NBC News and Special Events Department has come to you from London and New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.